Stephon Blanford isn't running for re-election this fall to the Seattle School Board. He's represented the Central District for the past 4 years. He said he ran for office because he wanted to ensure that every child in Seattle has access to a high-quality education. As this school year was ending, Blanford sat down with Ann Dornfeld from KUOW's Race and Equity team.
The school board's considered a pretty thankless job. What inspired you to run?
Going way back, my family was one of those families that you see mired in generational poverty, and access to high-quality education, public education, has been the difference for me and my siblings and my cousins, whereas my mother and previous generations didn't have that access. And so I felt inspired to try to add what I could to the idea of high-quality education, making sure that everyone has access to it. I earned a doctorate a few years ago at University of Washington and felt inspired as a result of that to be able to hopefully to add value to the conversations in Seattle about that type of access. And so that's what inspired me to run.
How did the reality of the board and what you could accomplish differ from your hopes and expectations?
The jury's still out. I think there's still work to be done. And I've come to realize that you get the opportunity to put a brick in the wall. You don't get the opportunity to just totally transform systems. That said, I've struggled with the fact that I've been on the losing end of way too many votes on issues that affect our achievement and opportunity gaps. And that's part of the reason that I chose not to run again.
What changes have you seen in the opportunity gap in Seattle schools during your four-year tenure on the school board?
Well, it's hard to know what the baseline was, but I do know the study that came out last year from Stanford that said that we are the fifth worst school, large urban school district in the nation in terms of our achievement and opportunity gaps between our white students and our African-American students. And I believe the numbers are similar for the other subgroups of students. And I believe really strongly that in this community that is as wealthy as it is and as committed to public education as it is and as educated as it is, that that's a pretty unconscionable metric that we would have such large opportunity gaps for a school system that serves all of the city.
And of course, it's hard to know what the current status is, right? Because the Stanford data was looking back only to 2012 or earlier.
Right. But I would believe that that number hasn't changed significantly because, again, it's difficult to all of a sudden make huge change happen. There have been some positive changes. I believe that one of the biggest changes is we now have the Seattle preschool program. And there's probability that more students will actually arrive at the kindergarten door ready to learn. And if they do that, then I think there's much higher probability that the size of that gap will shrink eventually.
A resolution before the school board would encourage more ethnic studies lessons in K-12 classes. Ethnic studies have been shown to make school more relevant for kids of color and improve their achievement. But the school board's proposal doesn't go as far as the NAACP resolution that inspired it because it doesn't put a timeline on the rollout of ethnic studies or make it mandatory for graduation. Do you think that the school board's resolution goes far enough?
I have spent some time looking at the actual language of the resolution. I know that right now those are difficult conversations to have in classrooms and that teachers have to be well prepared to manage the conversation. There are many excellent teachers in Seattle Public Schools who are inspired by the idea. The ability to manage those types of conversations in ways that don't lead to alienating one group versus another, I think are going to be essential. And that would be something that I would insist on in that resolution.
So do you think that it's important to not put a tight timeline on it because it's to be seen how long it will take to figure out the definition of ethnic studies, how it should be taught, to train teachers, develop or find curricula?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you've gotten at the core issue, which is our ability to put something in classrooms that'll actually accomplish the goal that has been set. It takes a while. It's not something that just because an outside group decides it's essential for us to do it, that you know, tomorrow it will be happening. It takes a while to develop the curricula. It takes a while to get teachers appropriately trained to lead that type of curriculum.
When Seattle teachers bargained their current contract, they called for the formation of race and equity teams at several dozen schools to look at how schools can improve outcomes for students of color. Do you see teachers as leading the district when it comes to closing the opportunity gap?
In my 3.5 years on the board, I have seen very excellent teachers who care very deeply about the achievement and opportunity gaps. Many of them were inspired to go into the classroom because they saw the disparities. We also have teachers that that's not their primary concern. And so trying to figure out ways to make it part of the culture of the entire school is the work of those race and equity teams, racial equity teams inside of schools. I've had the opportunity to work with many of them, and I see them as catalysts for moving that conversation forward and then making sure that it changes the culture of the school. I would argue that we're not moving fast enough on that issue, but I also recognize that it takes time.
What can the school board do to help desegregate a district in a highly segregated city like Seattle, where students are assigned to schools based on where they live?
You've gotten at the core issue in our assignment plan, which basically is that we want kids to go to the school that's closest to their home, because then we're spending less money transporting them from place to place. Before the new assignment plan was put into place, I remember looking at a map that showed where kids live and where they went to school, and it colored the entire map because you couldn't count on kids actually going to the school that was in their neighborhood. For many families that don't have a school in their neighborhood that is high quality, that gives them an out, an opportunity to go somewhere else. But now as we've constrained that ability, I worry that we are therefore mandating that kids go to schools that may not be high quality enough for them. And I think we are struggling with how to diversify our student populations when we have such a segregation in the neighborhoods that the kids are in. There's not an easy solution, because we could burn up large percentage of our budget just in transporting kids back and forth. The board before me put into place this plan with the idea that all schools will be high quality, so there won't be a need to transport them all over the city. We are getting there, but we have not gotten there yet.
But of course, it could be argued that part of the quality of a school is, in fact, how diverse it is.
Right.
It's not just who's teaching and what's being taught, right?
I would agree wholeheartedly to that notion. I wonder sometimes, though, if our community as a whole doesn't recognize how important that is, that part of education, particularly in the 21st century, is going to be the ability to work across culture, work with people who are not like you. Many of our schools are not very diverse, and many of our constituents are pushing towards efforts to ensure that that is happening. When we try to promote the idea that a diverse school and classroom is beneficial, we actually get pushback from folks in communities.
You said that parents in Seattle often want their child to attend a school that's diverse, but not too diverse.
Right.
Why do you think that is?
I read a study, I'm not remembering the author of the study, who tried to quantify what is the threshold number of kids of color in a school where white parents will say, that's a good school, I want my child to go there. And if it goes over that number, then those same parents are less likely to enroll their kids. I didn't remember what the author said the threshold number is, but it's not very high. It's not very high. I think it's less than 10%. And if it gets more than that, then there's a perception that the school is not high quality. And, in the progressive city that we live in, I always want to challenge that and say, why do you believe that if your child were in a school that is primarily students of color, why would you automatically believe that that can't be a high quality school? I don't know what the answer to that is, but I would love to figure out a way to actually put that in front of parents and have them grapple with that.
Do you think that white parents in Seattle know that about themselves?
I hope I don't get myself into trouble, but I believe that in many ways, our parents, many of our white parents, there's a disconnect between what they believe in their heart of hearts and how they act. And, you know, as a parent myself, I know that my first and primary responsibility is to advocate for the best possible situations for my child. And I believe that that is what all parents do all of the time. There's a fundamental dissonance between if you have a preconceived notion that black and brown kids can't learn at the same rates as white and Asian kids, then I think there is an automatic default to wanting your child to be in a diverse class, but not too diverse.
Do you see issues of segregation within school buildings that on paper would appear to be diverse schools?
Yes. There are three schools in the district that I represent, and I would believe that probably in every district in Seattle, there are a number of schools where the teachers have come to me and said, there is rampant segregation in our building when we line up all of our kids and we send the highly capable kids in one direction and we send the general ed kids in a different direction. You can see the racial segregation play out just by kids lining up. That has played out in several of the schools in my district. And so, again, I believe that it probably plays out in most districts where it's profound and it's right in your face, where you see all the black and brown kids on one side and all the white and Asian kids on the other side. Our teachers and our administrators, when they see that, are able to call it out. And some of our parents are pretty passionate about when they see their kids lining up on either side of that equation, not feeling like that's what public education should be. And surely that's not what the capabilities of the students are. And so when they call that out and try to take action on it, I'm always supportive. There have been times where that gets challenged.
Do you think that the school board has aided and abetted that?
Yes. I want to believe unintentionally. I would suggest that in my 4 years on the board, I've tried to articulate, if we make a decision, a policy decision, in one way, what the ramifications of that policy decision for our efforts to foster equity and close gaps. There have been times where I've been the sole vote on an issue like that. And after a lot of 6-to-1 votes, at some point it becomes not the best use of my time, figuring that I can advocate externally better than I can internally.
Having sat through my share of school board meetings over the years, there are far more white faces in the audience than in your average classroom in Seattle schools. How do you see the folks who lobby the board as influencing its agenda when it comes to equity?
That is a great question. They do. They strongly do influence the board. And you should know that the school board meetings are an opportunity for parents to come and articulate their feelings on policy positions that we're going to take. What you don't see is the emails that we get, the campaigns that are launched by people of goodwill who care very deeply about their individual school. But in their advocacy for their individual school, sometimes are working to the detriment of other schools. This weekend, I was in a meeting with a lot of angry parents who were concerned about our wait lists and wanting us to change our wait list policy so that their school would be more full, they would get more resources, and their children would benefit as a result. And the struggle for that is, for me as a school board director who has responsibility for 14 or 15 schools in the Central District, but all schools, as a school board director, we make policies that affect, you know, the 100 schools that we have in Seattle Public Schools. Trying to strike a balance, because to do what this parent group wants would be detrimental to another school. And in school board meetings, in the email campaigns that go on, and in lots of other ways, parents articulate and advocate for their individual school, but sometimes at the detriment of other schools. And I try to figure out ways to get folks to see the big picture, and that if we pit one school versus another, eventually those who lose are those parents who are not organized, or those parents who don't have access to a school board director, and those who choose not to go to a school board meeting. And so ultimately, just trying to put on the table, there are winners and losers with every decision that we make. And if you are truly an advocate for educational equity, you have to factor that into your advocacy. I think, and ultimately, we need to try to figure out ways to increase the size of the pie. And that's, you know, working through our legislature, advocating with our legislature for the amount of funding that's necessary to run 100 school buildings and to educate 54,000 students and growing, daily.
What do you think has to be in place besides that funding from the legislature to close the opportunity gap for kids of color in Seattle schools?
Well, in my research around the country, there are districts, many districts, that have far less resources than Seattle Public Schools has, and their gaps are, equivalent. Not very many of them have the fifth worst achievement gap in the nation, but many of them have gaps very similar to ours. And so in some ways it is about money, but it's not only about money. I believe in my heart of hearts that it's about leadership. And it's about a community coming together and speaking passionately about what it believes, and then tasking its representatives, being school board directors and superintendents, to act on that vision. I think we struggle with that right now. And I think particularly in a time where we're under-resourced as a system, it is human nature to then start advocating for what is best for you, instead of what's best for the community as a whole. And in this time, particularly with the economy growing, with Seattle being a go-to city that people want to come to and raise families in, I think we have to deal with that issue sooner rather than later, because if we don't, we'll have the segregation that you talked about. We'll have the disparate outcomes. We'll have a system that serves many of our population very well and some of our population really poorly. And it'll be more difficult over time to interrupt that and disrupt that.
I've spoken to a lot of parents and teachers over the years who have said that they think that the district has a really good platitude game and talks a lot about closing the opportunity gap and doing right by young Black boys, et cetera, but doesn't really put their money where their mouth is. Do you think that's the case?
Yes, in large measure, I do think that that's the case. I think that you asked the question at the start of this conversation about why I chose to run. And I will say that I chose to run because I believe that I had the kind of the right skill set to try to push that issue. And the 6-to-1 votes that have occurred over time prove to me that that's not the case. As many emails as I get saying that that folks are not concerned about schools that are not like their own or serve their children, there are many people in our community who believe passionately that our school system should be more equitable, should be driving resources to those students who are underperforming for one reason or another. They are not nearly as organized as those who are advocating for their own individual interests.
When you think back on some of those 6-to-1 votes, what were the most painful?
There are numerous ones, but one in particular still grates for me, and it was one of my colleagues has taken a position for a long time that standardized assessments are bad, inherently bad. And so I did a little bit of research on that, and I found a letter that was written to the Congress, and it was written by 20-plus national organizations that are advocacy organizations for children. The NAACP, the National Council of La Raza, an advocacy group that advocates for special ed kids, an advocacy group that advocates for kids in foster care and in the correctional system. And they wrote a letter to Congress saying assessments actually are a good thing, particularly for our kids, because they show the system is not serving our kids well, and they disparities in educational outcomes then drive resources to those schools, to schools that are underperforming. So I read this letter almost in its entirety into the record before we took the vote on this resolution, which said we as Seattle Public Schools believe that standardized testing is bad. And that was a 6-1 vote. And, there are legitimate reasons why we need to interrogate standardized assessments. The arguments that were used by my colleagues and others had to do with the amount of time that is spent in assessments. And we are 50% under what the standard recommendation or guideline says that we should. So that's not, in my mind, that's not an acceptable argument. I think ultimately many of the children of the people who are advocating on the other side of that issue will take tests. They'll take tests to get into college. They'll take tests to get into their first job. But the stories that I heard about how detrimental it was for us to mandate tests on kids actually, I think, does a disservice, particularly to our low-performing kids. And that one, it was hard to sleep that night after that vote was taken, because I thought it was so very clear that there's a group of students who benefit from this, and there are a whole lot of students that will suffer as a result of this resolution.
There are a lot of people who think that standardized testing actually discriminates against kids of color and low-performing students. Do you think that your counterparts on the board were doing what they thought was the right thing for kids of color, and that you have philosophical differences?
There are philosophical differences on that. Having a doctorate in education research, I know both sides of that argument. And particularly as an African-American man, I know that there are biases in most tests. And I struggle with that as well. But I think looking at it from the big picture, I know that those tests are responsible for the results of those tests help us to allocate dollars appropriately to schools that desperately need additional resources in order to improve the outcomes that they have for their students. When you don't have any kind of objective assessment to be able to compare school X versus school Y, then that's the one tool that those of us who are advocating for equity have. When you take that tool away, then it will be easier, I believe, to do what some parents would have us do, which is to allocate funds to the schools that are already doing well versus those who are struggling. And I believe that's bad for our city. I think that's bad for democracy as a whole.
You've also said that you've heard things at school board meetings that just felt outright racist to you. What are some examples of that?
Well, without rehashing a very uncomfortable, unpleasant situation, I will say that there have been pretty what we would call racial microaggressions manifested by board members on other board members and on staff and on community members who've come to testify. Those have been well documented. It's not very hard to find. But I think they highlight the fact that there is a need for the board, and I think the boards of most communities, so not singling out Seattle specifically, But there's a need for us to do lots of personal work in order to fulfill our role as the on the top of the org chart of a billion-dollar organization that impacts the lives of 54,000 students. And because we are a district that has more students of color than we do white students, there is some sense of urgency around that. It's not something that we should do at some point in the future. There's, in my mind, because of the huge disparities that we have, there's a requirement that we do that soon.
What's it been like being the only black person on a mostly white school board?
It has been the experience of my life to be a school board director. I never thought that I would have run for office and to have the opportunity to serve the community that I've lived in for 20 plus years now has been an honor. As an African-American man, it has been both rewarding and hugely frustrating. I believe that many of the people that voted for me, and I did very well in my election, some of them voted for me because I'm a black man. And that's an interesting thing in our city. I think there are many cities in the United States that a black man couldn't say that, but I can say that in Seattle. And I think that's something that we should celebrate. But in the process of campaigning as a school board director and then serving as a school board director, I've experienced some racial microaggressions. I've experienced people with unrealistic expectations of what I could do. And it's been not the easiest thing. It's been pretty hard to be a black man. I'm not the first one, and I hope that I won't be the last. But it's not an easy experience.
After 4 years on the board, you've decided that this will be your last term. Why is that?
There are several reasons. In our history of American education class, they talked about the fact that there's a tradition in American education where school board directors serve because they are committed to their community and therefore don't require any financial compensation. My school board service, I've spent on average between 25 and 30 hours a week being a school board director. And at some point, financially, that isn't feasible. You can't do that for very long, especially in my prime wage earning years. So that's one piece of it. But I knew that going in. I knew that I wasn't going to be compensated for being a school board director, and I still wanted to do it. The 6-to-1 votes are really hard, and at some point you figure this is probably not the best use of my time. I still care passionately, and maybe I can do something from another platform rather than being a school board director. School board directors have a harder time just being in a grocery store or a restaurant because people see you and they feel like they have a right to intrude on your privacy, and that's happened on several occasions, and it's really difficult for myself and my family.
What advice do you have for your successor?
I hope that all three new board members, or two board members, because there's one incumbent that is running in this upcoming cycle, I hope that they have a skill set that allows them to manage, to provide governance rather than manage, provide governance of a billion-dollar institution, and you have a huge amount of power and authority that comes along with that. And I want people to come at it with the right reason and to not come at it because they have an individual problem that they want to solve. It requires folks that are well-skilled in lots of different areas and have the ability to see the grand vision and act on it. I also believe, obviously, that those achievement and opportunity gaps that we have should not continue, and that I would hope that board members can come in able to add value to that conversation and provide guidance that will help to close those gaps, or at least, at very least, not stand firm when they run up against obstacles that would push them in the opposite direction. I think that is, those are two elements that are absolutely crucial for the next board. But I think it's even more crucial that voters take that on as a responsibility and vet candidates based on at least those two indicators, hopefully more, but at least those two indicators. If you want to eventually see a school system that's making progress, educating all of our students, but paying particular attention to those that are not doing well.
What's next for you?
I've alluded to it several times that I want to continue to fight this fight, probably from the outside. I'm going through a process right now where I'm trying to identify what's going to be next for me, because I feel like I've exposed myself to a lot of different experiences that will lend themselves to taking a position that's going to be a strong advocate. And I'm not sure what that is just yet. I'm looking forward to rebuilding relationships with my wife and my daughter, having spent way too much time away from them. But I'm excited about what's next for me.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.